Save your numbers for now.
Your number's absolutely.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Make sure this is on silent. Is there a clock in here so I don't have to stare at my phone?
Right there.
Okay, I'll look at that one. Yeah. So I have till 2 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll do this. Yeah.
You'll do the notes thing. Okay, perfect. Okay. There. All right. Hi, I'm Allie, and I'm a grateful recovering codependent.
Hi, Allie.
I thought I'd be more nervous than I am, but you guys are all have such wonderful energy that I feel pretty comfortable. So, I want to start with the word grateful. Today I am grateful. This means I show appreciation for what I have rather than focusing on what I don't have in my life. I even spend time being grateful for the things that still go wrong because all of them have brought me to this very point where I'm standing right here today talking to all of you. So before recovery, I was anything but grateful. I was fearful. I was resentful. I was anxious, worried. I was sad. I was lonely. I was miserable. I felt rejected by others, and I felt desperate to be what I thought was love at the time. I now know that what I was looking for in my disease was adoration and admiration from others. I wanted to be placed on a pedestal and told that I was amazing and special. I was stuck in the past and tripping into the future. I was certainly not present. And because I was not present, I wasn't happy, joyous, and free like the promises guarantee us if we work the 12 steps of the program of codependency recovery. I first heard of the word codependent when I was 24 years old. It was from my ex-husband's coworker. He told me that my husband and I were codependent on each other. And it didn't match because I was like, we don't spend all of our time together. I can't be codependent. So I brushed it off and I didn't revisit that term for 2 years. And I now understand codependency to be a deeply rooted compulsive disease born out of our moderately or severely dysfunctional family systems. Due to the dysfunction of our family systems during childhood, we're unable to develop a secure sense of self. So instead, we find our identity in others. We learn to control or become dependent on others in order to feel some sense of value and security. When I learned that codependency was a disease, I had a hard time at first accepting this. I read the definition of a disease, and it actually matched the definition of codependency pretty perfectly. So the definition of disease is a particular quality, habit, or disposition regarded as adversely affecting a person or group of people. So today I know that I have a spiritual disease. There is no known cure for it. I will have it forever. That part I cannot control. The part that I do have control is maintaining regular and diligent work on myself through the steps of my program. When working the steps, I am guaranteed through the promises that I can go from surviving life to thriving in life. And so now I'm going to go a little bit into my childhood. I had what I would call a moderately dysfunctional childhood, if I had to pick one. There wasn't noticeable chemical dependency or mental health issues that were noticeable. My family was consistent, sometimes consistently awful, but there was not really, you know, it was, to at least when I was in my family system, it kind of seemed fine. My dad was now what I know to be a rageaholic, and my mom had breast cancer for most of my childhood and young adult years. And the energy in my household was a combination of anxious and angry. And so to break down my family, the only family I knew, it was very small. It was my mom and dad who were still married. It was my paternal grandma and grandpa who were still married until they passed, and my aunt and uncle and cousin. And then my younger sister. That was the family. We did vacations and holidays together. That's all I knew. And so besides my uncle, every other member in our family was the youngest. My cousin was an only, but they were all the youngest. And so because of this, I felt like nobody in my family could relate to me. I felt like this weird mixture of being ultra responsible, perfect firstborn child, perfect first grandchild, older sister, kind of mixed with this person who was a burden, who never did anything right, especially behaviorally. And so to go a little deeper into my behavioral issues, I had what I now know to be a diagnosis of ADHD. So throughout my childhood, I struggled with hyperactivity and impulse control issues. In preschool, I blurted out to my preschool teacher, "You're fat." In fourth grade, I had a teacher who refused to teach me, told my parents that she wouldn't teach me unless I was medicated. In sixth grade at soccer, in front of the girl's dad, I said, "What's wrong with that man who had MS?" And each of these behaviors, they felt so innocent and honest as they came out, but they were met with such harsh criticism, understandably. My parents matched this level of criticism by constantly pointing out my wrongdoings. My dad, as I mentioned, had a terrible temper, and he screamed at me almost every day for something that I was doing wrong. The only thing that really kind of saved me at the time was I had a best friend since I was five, and she's still my best friend today, and my paternal grandmother, who's the most amazing woman I've ever known. otherwise, I feel like I would have completely rejected myself. Those were the things that held me together at the time. But the way I viewed that others viewed me was that I was the Dennis the Menace, or for those of you who are Full House or Fuller House fans, the Kimmy Gibbler. And I was annoying, I was in the way, I was causing problems, I felt lonely and rejected a lot of the time. So when I was in fifth grade, my mom shared at the dinner table that she had breast cancer, and I remember starting to cry, and my dad yelled at me and said, "This is not about you," and told me to go to my room. And that was when I learned, and maybe a mixture of other experiences, that it was not safe for me to share emotions, and it was not safe for me to have emotions. And so after my mother's cancer diagnosis, I was placed in this in-between role of dad's scapegoat and my sister's caretaker. This reinforced that mixture of ultra responsible mixed with annoying and can't do anything right, and I'm in the way. As an outlet, I learned to control and manipulate friends. I would have friends over to my house, and I would force them to do dance routines and choreography and things that I could control. Like, I didn't even understand how to play. Everything was controlled and organized. Sometimes our activities were innocent, and as we got older, some were rebellious and not innocent. And during my childhood, I also carried a secret with me. I couldn't read. I was a nearly straight A student who read so incredibly slow and could not process what I was reading. I felt so much shame, and I thought I was stupid. Also during that, around fifth grade, I was severely bullied. I can recall students saying, you know, I have AIDS, or they'd put gum in my hair. I missed, 100 days of school in fifth grade. So here I was with both low internal and external resources. To cope, I escaped into overcompensating in school and with grades. I studied long hours. I manipulated other students into helping me. I begged teachers for additional time on exams, for additional time to turn things in, and for extra credit. I worked really hard athletically, so I did pretty much every extracurricular activity that you can imagine, and I excelled in swimming, gymnastics, and dance. This is where I felt normal. I was and had to be the best at every sport that I did. My teammates were not friends. They were competitors or obstacles. They were in the way of my success. I learned to measure my self-worth on being better than whoever I or the coaches or teachers perceived to be the best. I didn't even understand the idea of progress, not perfection. Everything was perfection. It was all perfection, all day, every day. I must not let anyone know how stupid or annoying I am. I must be untouchable. I must be up here or out there. I have to hide so that others can't see what a piece of shit I actually am. In my teen years, I learned to be less sloppy and noticeable with my control and manipulation and annoying behaviors. I learned to be funny. I learned to be the class clown. I learned to be wild and charming to my teachers and my coaches. I pretended to not be competitive with my friends, but when they weren't looking, I'd stab them in the back and have to be better than they were. My reading started to get better. I became a star athlete. I was finally holding on to friends. My mom was in remission, and my dad was becoming less of a helicopter parent, not screaming at me as much, and he found other interests to get involved in. So my junior year of high school, I got into a long-term relationship with a boyfriend. The relationship kind of started as a little bit of a scandal. He was 3 years older than me, and he was the assistant coach of the swim team that I was on. And so we were together for 6 years on and off. And in that relationship, I realized I developed my dad's temper. And also later realized that this relationship was similar. I was in a relationship with someone treating me kind of similar to how I had felt I was treated when I was growing up. The boyfriend minimized me and discouraged any talk about or validation of my feelings or any feelings. And he often treated me like I was ridiculous. And in turn, I would lash out at him with rage. He wasn't cruel or anything. He was sort of this combination of infatuated with me, comforting fatherly figure, and absent and dismissive. It was really confusing. We played this daily cat and mouse game of break up, ignore each other, get anxious, get back together. And the relationship became a distraction from my life. It became an addiction. Looking back, I missed out on so many opportunities in high school to hang out with friends and be present because the relationship highs and lows were so much more important to me. Somehow, amongst that chaos, I managed to get a scholarship to Davis to play water polo. And I get to college and I'm, for the first 2 years, lonely, empty. I didn't know myself. I didn't even know that I needed to know myself. So I saw a doctor, got on psych meds, was diagnosed with generalized anxiety, ADHD, obsessive compulsive disorder. The meds worked. At the time, I started to feel okay. And so my junior year of college, I started abusing my prescriptions. I was drinking. I was smoking weed too much. I was feeling numb and wanting quick fixes. I had an overinflated ego. I was with being a starter on the water polo team and then an All-American Division I water polo player. Guys paid attention to me, so I manipulated them for my esteem. I felt better than everyone else. I was the life of the party. I had lots of fun, and I thought I was happy. And I was actually running from myself, staying distracted and using people as a platform to stand on so I could be better than them. So here's the crash after college, and I kind of equate it to being a child star. Everything I'd ever worked for, school and sports, were now behind me. Little did I know that I had spent so much of my time in life around what I did and very little time focusing on who I was. I was lost. The summer after I graduated from college, I met my ex-husband at a bar in my hometown. He was blackout drunk, and I took him home that night. After I tucked him into bed and looked around at the room and all of his psych medications, empty beer bottles, and perfectly decorated apartment, I remembered thinking two things. This guy needs me to save him, to save his life. And wow, what a nice apartment. If I date this guy, I can move out of my parents' house and live with him. And this is exactly what I did. We moved in together 2 weeks after we met. During the 2 weeks, I learned that he had had 3 DUIs, had no license, no relationship with his dad, his mother. He and his mother were enmeshed with each other. She'd even deliver groceries to our doorstep and not come in, just deliver the groceries. And he would share stories with me of his drug-filled nights in college and how he almost died many times. his life and perspective on life were so different than anything I'd ever encountered. I thought it was exciting, so I stuck around for the thrill in the beginning, and I stayed to try and save and fix him. I remembered thinking that my life until now had been pretty consistent. I coached in the community. I was with my high school boyfriend on and off for 6 years, and I remembered thinking I just wanted to stop doing what everyone else expected of me and just do something different. So I did. My ex was charming in the beginning, but over time he began emotionally controlling me and later physically abusing me. We lived in California for a while. He pulled a gun on me and nearly choked me to death. When I called the police and the police showed, I got scared and blamed the entire thing on myself. That next day, I showed up to coaching swim with a hooded sweatshirt on in like 102 degree weather, just to hide the choke marks on my neck. And I thought I was hiding from people, and I saw parents looking at me like, are you okay? And I didn't see it at the time. And I swore that day that I was going to leave him, but he told me he was sorry and promised to change and stop drinking and using substances. So naturally I moved with him to Florida. Let me just get a little quick sip-a-roo. There we worked for his dad's real estate company and lived in one of his properties. Over time, he isolated me. He told me what I could and couldn't eat. He told me I wasn't smart enough, pretty enough, or skinny enough, and that I needed to know my place in the cycle of life. He would shame me that if I did eat, so I would eat and pretend I didn't eat. He would grab my cheeks and say, somebody's been eating cheese and bread. I tried to leave him once, only to return back to Florida and eventually marry him, without telling my friends or family. And when they found out, they were hurt. I felt guilty, but I was so deep in this relationship that what my ex thought of me at the time was so much more important than anything or anybody. During this time, I remember my ex would take off for days at a time. I would spend entire weekends as a ball of nerves. I would pace the house. I would Swiffer the floor. I would do anything just to keep myself distracted and busy. I would check the arrest records to see if he was in jail. I would call his dealers to see if they'd seen him. I would check credit card statements by calling and saying that I was my ex. He had a unisex name. And just to find out where he was staying. I was never sure if he was dead in jail or in a hospital. And so about a year and a half of the chaos, I'd reached my breaking point. Something in me finally realized that if I didn't leave him, he was going to kill me. So I left him, but not until after he'd called me one night and said he'd found someone else and that he was releasing me and I could go back to California and be back with my ex-boyfriend, who probably still loved me. Instead of being upset, I was relieved. I packed my stuff in one night, and I called everyone I could back in California to tell them everything that he had done to me. My phone bill was $1,500 from calling every person that I could think of and telling them the story, telling them everything I'd been hiding for years. And this was back when cell phones didn't have long distance minutes. I think I actually ended up getting it negotiated down to like $200, but still. After I left him, I was disappointed that it took him finding someone else for me to leave, and instead of the first time he hit me for me to leave. I realized that I valued a warm body over nobody. That's how low my self-worth had gotten. As long as somebody was paying attention to me, it didn't matter. It was okay to treat me poorly. So I came home, both relieved and defeated, as if I'd failed at something. And that I thought everybody was going to say, we told you so. Nobody said, I told you so. Instead, my family and friends embraced me with open arms. There was no judgment. There was lots of support and compassion. My mom actually, who had never opened up to me about much of her life, opened up to me and said that she'd been married before and that she could relate to that feeling I was going through of failure and reassured me that everything was going to be okay. So instead of immediately getting help for the trauma I'd gone through, I jumped into another relationship. One that was fun, with very little commitment and responsibility. This actually turned out to be a good thing. This person knew my ex from childhood and also had been traumatized by him. And he encouraged me to just go to 4 therapy sessions, and that if I hated it, I didn't have to keep going. At first, I was resistant to therapy, but then after finding out that my ex had overdosed and was in a coma, I was feeling lots of guilt and fear, as if it was my fault that he'd overdosed, and I was afraid that I'd go back to him and try to rescue him. So instead, I chose to stay in therapy. I liked therapy and was even inspired to go to grad school, where I later became a therapist. While in grad school, I was in a chemical dependency class and were asked to go attend a 12-step meeting. So I attended an AA meeting with a classmate. After listening to the shares and when they asked if any newcomers would like to share, I started with, "I'm Allie, and I can relate to everything everyone in here has been saying today. Only I'm not addicted to substances, I'm addicted to people." I could not believe those words were coming out of my mouth. In my next therapy session, I told my therapist all about the experience I'd had at NA. And instead of dismissing the word as I had when I'd learned about it 2 years before, this time I went on the CODA website. I also got the book Codependent No More and started to read it. After reading the book, I remembered running down the stairs at my parents' house, yelling at my dad, "You did this to me." There was clearly some work to do in order to focus on my healing journey, but it was a start. I attended my first CODA meeting on September 10th, 2008. I remember walking in early to a group of men sitting together. I asked, "Is this a men's meeting only? Is this a men's only meeting?" And one of the members turned out to be an incredible mentor in my life, laughed and jokingly said, "Well, it ain't no more. Come on in." I remember seeing these people and they seemed peaceful and happy, and I wanted that. So I kept coming back. I made good friends who are still friends today. And I even met my husband in CODA. During the early stages of recovery, I learned that my ex-husband had passed away from an overdose. Instead of guilt that I had done something wrong this time with the help of recovery, I was able to identify that I was responsible for me and my ex was responsible for himself. I no longer felt the same level of guilt and shame or responsibility for saving or fixing others. I was in charge of continuing to discover me and practice my recovery. What a relief. What stood out for me in the beginning of program was that I came in thinking that I would learn better strategies or nicer ways to get others around me to change, and I stayed to work on myself. I learned I had to listen to and trust myself. With the program and the steps, I had the ability to take my inventory and no longer rely on faulty dysfunctional coping mechanisms or defects of character. Those were no longer working for me. And in fact, they'd never really been working. They just made my life more complicated. So as I mentioned, my experiences led me to become a therapist. I often tell people that I use more of what I've learned in CODA recovery to help my clients than I ever did based on my education and training. This is because the steps lay it out for you in such a simple way. So now I'm going to go over each of the steps and sort of how I did the steps. So step one, admitted that we were powerless over others and that our lives had become unmanageable. So for me, coming to terms that I'm not powerful over others, I can't fix anyone but myself. I first really saw this when my ex died. I did everything I could to try to keep him alive and sober, believing I was powerful enough to keep him alive, fearing if he died on my watch, it would be my fault. He died anyway. I couldn't keep him alive, and it was not my fault. This was my ultimate reminder of powerlessness. As painful as this experience was, it was and is the most humbling to date. It keeps me grounded in remembering what I can control. And I use the tool of, for step one, in remembering that I can only control whatever's inside of a hula hoop. Step two, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So as a kid, I attended church and youth groups and camps. And my idea of God was a man in the clouds who looked like a wizard, and he would judge and punish us. And I was afraid of God. In program, I learned that I could create God or a higher power of my own understanding. This was really comforting to me. At first, I made the group, the collective energy of CODA, my higher power. And I now see God as everything that is love, that's light, that's warm, that's nurturing, that's comforting and forgiving. So step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. So once I had a more comforting version of my higher power, it was much easier to make a decision to turn my will over to something other than me. I also understand that the first three steps are a daily and sometimes hourly practice. It's okay for me to give it over to my higher power, only to take it back and then give it back to my higher power again. I'm human. And this is where I remember the concept of progress, not perfection. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I was told by my first sponsor and others in recovery to just go for it. And if I miss something, it's okay. I'll go back through the steps again. It's like peeling an onion. If I don't catch or notice something this time around, I'll get it the next time. The fourth step was where I learned that I will be doing the steps for the rest of my life. There is no finish line in recovery. I get to step 12 and then I go back to step one. I will continue to learn and grow, and that's a beautiful thing. Therefore, no need to be in a hurry and no need to do it perfectly. In fact, don't do it perfectly. There's no such thing as attaining perfection. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. So this process was and continues to be a relief to me. I remember to go in humbly. I don't need to be ashamed of what I'm saying. I know my higher power is guiding me, and I know that I can choose a safe person in recovery to share my truth. If I don't feel comfortable, I can set a boundary, or I can choose a different person or a different time to be open with my inventory. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I had a hard time with this word, entirely ready, at first, but I now know entirely ready to be ready is right now. Who knows how I will feel in a month from now, but in my current awareness, I'm ready. I also remember the recovery slogan that God can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. If I'm not entirely ready, I can ask my higher power for willingness to be ready or for increased focus or awareness. Step seven, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Humbly. I love learning about being humble and humility because it was something I didn't learn growing up. When I humbly ask my higher power to remove my defects of character, I'm acknowledging that I am no better or worse than anybody else. I do not have shame or guilt or remorse for who I was. I can come as I am today in my higher power, to my higher power, with all my strengths and all my weaknesses, and I can ask him to help restore me to sanity and manageability. Step eight, made a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. This is something for me where I noticed the importance of working the steps more than just once. Each time my list became shorter, but there were often people who were not on the list that ended up on my list later. And it feels good to get more out and resolved and humbly seeing humbly seeing the ways I continue to harm myself and others, and it's comforting to know that I have the steps to turn to when I do cause harm to an individual or to myself. That it's an ongoing, lifelong process. And step 9, made a direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So one thing that stood out to me with this step was the idea that the amends was not for others. I wasn't needing to be worried about how they would respond to the amends. It was none of my business. My amends was for me. This is something I needed to practice and get used to, that gave me a sense of empowerment, knowing that I can only control me, that my amends was from the heart without expectation, manipulation, or control. If I go into an amends with a pure and honest heart, that their response is on them. I do not need to be fragile or place my worth on how they see me, or what my amends means to them. It's all about me. Mm-hmm. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Okay, so I write out a 10th step recovery checklist. It's in the recovery green book, and I hung it on my wall next to my bed so that I can look at it each morning, each evening, and it's like a daily self-care, self-cleanse. And to hold myself accountable, I'm not great about it right now. Just even speaking about it in here in front of all of you makes me want to remember to go back and do that daily inventory, because it feels so good to go in and do go over the checklist and in a way without judgment. And so step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. So one tip that I received from a mentor in CODA was that the easiest way to connect with the higher power is to do the first 3 steps first and then do the 11th step in order to connect. And so the example that he gave was of a lamp, and that you have to turn the knob. If you just turn the knob of a lamp and it's not plugged in, the lamp is not going to light up, but you have to plug in, and those first 3 steps are plugging in, and then the 11th step is turning the knob and then connecting. And so if we're in a place where we just kind of are like talking to God and we haven't done those first 3 steps, it's maybe a little harder, and it's easier if we'd done the 3 steps and then found that connection. Okay, so the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to other codependents and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. So I strengthen my own recovery just as much when I sponsor as when I'm being sponsored. I hear myself speaking to a sponsee or even to all of you today, and it reinforces and reminds me to focus on my own recovery. Without us carrying the message, the program would no longer exist. Each of us is equally important in carrying the message and giving back to the program. I learned that sponsoring is not the only way to give back to the program that has given us so much. Just filling a seat or giving a share keeps the program going. So I'm not here to make my life sound like a Disney movie. It's where there's conflict in the beginning and everything's perfect at the end. I still have problems. I still had problems after finding CODA. I still struggle, but I am living life, not surviving. I find my way back to the steps and back to my moral compass. Today, I'm mostly good and also human. I'm mostly humble and sometimes fall back on my old coping skills that no longer suit me. I often need a bit of pain to motivate me back to picking up a recovery book or to practice one of my recovery tools. The difference now is that I don't get into my disease as often and I don't stay there as long. I now have a roadmap to find my way back on track, and that's a blessing. So, one of the things that I still struggle with is raising my 3 stepchildren. The 2 hardest parts were knowing my role and detaching from the addicts in their life. I learned in program that I was transferring my addiction to controlling intimate partners, from controlling intimate partners to controlling my ex-husband's son and his ex, who were both struggling with mental health and addiction. I learned that I was addicted to chaos, that I was so used to something going wrong or needing to burden me that if my intimate relationship was going well, I needed to find something in my life that was not going well. So with the support of my sponsor and others in recovery, I joined Al-Anon to support moving through my resentments toward addicts and my addiction to chaos. To me, CODA was where I learned to have compassion for me, and Al-Anon was where I learned to have compassion for those still suffering. This in turn allowed me to spend more time having compassion for myself and my loved ones rather than resentment towards addicts in order to fuel my addiction and need for chaos and to suffer. I've gone through a lot of changes in the last 2 years. Prior to this, I struggled with fear that I would never become a biological parent. I had fear that I wasn't good enough, or that I was being punished for not being a good person as a kid, and life wasn't happening on my terms. So I felt less than compared to my friends who were all having babies. I had the thought of all I'll ever be is a step parent, which I absolutely love my stepchildren. It's not to minimize them, but just that feeling that I won't experience being a biological parent. But then I became pregnant and had a really hard pregnancy. I had some depression and rage while I was pregnant, and I went back to therapy, and I couldn't even sit through a recovery meeting. So I was hospitalized the last 3 weeks of my pregnancy with a condition that could have killed both me and the baby. And I had a scheduled C-section a month early. And so program really got me through the pregnancy, and specifically the last 3 weeks stay in the hospital before they delivered my daughter. And I practiced staying present and taking it day by day. I practiced gratitude for the friends and family who visited me, for the doctors taking care of me. When a fearful thought came into my mind, I would use my three steps to have my higher power replace my fear with hope and excitement. I continued to maintain my sanity by doing my 10th step checklist. My daughter was born. She was healthy. We went home right away. I could not believe that my life was becoming now beyond my wildest dreams. I had the hardest time getting pregnant and difficult pregnancy, and I had the most wonderful daughter and everything after delivery, and it was so smooth. I now know that I needed to go through all of it to be where I am today. With this baby who has a specific birth date, the process happened as it should have happened, and I'm grateful for all of it. So today I'm not attending as many meetings as I would like to. I do the phone meetings sometimes. I sponsor, I'm mentored. I do not do it perfectly, and I do not beat myself up over not doing my recovery perfectly. I'm aware that I get what I put into program. If I am restless, irritable, and discontent, I know where I need to go and what I need to do to get back on track of being happy, joyous, and free. So just to, as I'm about to end, here are some tools that I find helpful in program. I love the serenity prayer. The first three steps, and the way I do the first three steps is I kind of get into a meditative visualization of picturing myself almost noticing that I'm like suction cupped or attached to a person or an outcome, and then I visualize detaching from the person or the outcome. I practice the idea of pausing and asking myself, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What do I need? In that order. I use the idea of halt. So I ask myself to halt, or, you know, pause, halt. And am I hungry? Am I angry? Am I lonely? Am I tired? And then I go and take care of that need, rather than in the past where I'd feel dysregulated, get angry, yell at somebody, and then have to undo what I had done. I'm able to be aware of me and my needs. I like the recovery slogan, it is what it is. It keeps me out of anxiety. It keeps me out of judgment of myself. It keeps me out of the future. I like the concept progress, not perfection. I like the idea of yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery, now is a gift. That's why they call it the present. And the idea of taking things one day at a time. And if one day at a time doesn't work, taking my life 1 hour at a time, or 1 minute at a time, or 1 second at a time. And then I really like the idea of, is this really going to matter 5 years from now, 1 year from now, 1 month from now, 1 week from now, and so on. So that's about it. I'm Allie. I'm a grateful recovering codependent, and I really thank all of you for having me here today.